Shall we start, ladies and gentlemen? Firstly, I don't know the acoustics of this room, so I hope you can hear me. If you can't hear me, let me know, because there's nothing more irritating for you. You can't hear, okay? Is that better? Good. Thank you all very much for coming to this meeting. I think, firstly, let me apologise that Claire Short, who was actually on her way, and her ministerial car was turned round because of the situation. She hopes to come later on, but we're not sure whether she's going to be able to be here or not. And we don't know why she's gone away, so I can't give you any more details about that. But all the other speakers are here. Mary Caldor is here. Tony Giddens will be coming later on. He too, who'd hoped to introduce the meeting, will come and say a few words to us all before we disappear. And there is a reception afterwards at 7:30. Where, Mary?
Upstairs in the senior common room.
Upstairs in the senior common
room. Fifth floor.
Just let me say an introduction that, of course, the moment for this meeting couldn't be more apposite, nor its purpose more profound, I think, because we're facing a crisis of a very new kind and of global importance to all of us. We're also here to mark the publication of the first Global Civil Society Yearbook, a fascinating book which I've been reading in bed recently, and it hasn't sent me to sleep. And it has all sorts of messages for us, and I hope that you'll all go out and buy a copy if you haven't already got a copy. But if there is to be a solution to some of the problems that we face at this moment, then perhaps that solution has to encompass understanding. And look just how ignorant we in the West are. I think it's been heavily underlined, our ignorance about Islam, about Muslim communities, and about the realities of poverty. Perhaps Muslims too must put their house in order and move towards the difficult task of creating a decent democratic life for citizens. And those are some of the things that we might discuss. But as I work in news, I'm terribly conscious of words and the language that we use. And we search for the right word to describe things all day long. But you realize how differently we use words, words like God, words like justice, words like crusade, like trust, terrorist, freedom fighter, revolutionary, that we all look at these words from different angles and in different ways. And I found a quotation the other day when I was reading something else, which I thought you might find interesting. And it's from Henry Kissinger, someone who we all know, who is chairman of something called the Eisenhower Fellowships, which is a fellowship that brings together very bright young executives and financial people from all over the world. And he wrote in the introduction to the Eisenhower Fellowships, there may be some Eisenhower Fellows here, I don't know. Throughout my years in foreign policy, from my shuttle diplomacy in the Middle East to my negotiations in Vietnam, one condition has been essential: trust. I think it's a very interesting definition of trust. And it absolutely points up how differently we look at different words. The newly felt vulnerability in the United States may go hand in hand with newly learned perceptions. The fog is clearing there. Studs Terkel was quoted in the paper this morning saying that since last month's horrendous attacks, we have more empathy and awareness of others and are not so far removed from the rest of the world. There's a flood of news coverage that I'm very conscious of again, of September the 11th. It takes up two-thirds of every news bulletin in this country, day after day after day after day. But it's vastly overplayed if you compare the deaths of Iraqis, Palestinians, or the 20,000 in Grozny over the last decade. Say 1 million Iraqis who are estimated to have died over the last 10 years, 5% of the population there. In comparison, that would be 14 million Americans. So what are the hopes of this global civil society that we're discussing tonight? What hope that such a society might be secular when religion has played such a chilling and violent part in our common histories? Well, we have four speakers tonight. They're all going to speak for three speakers. They're all going to speak for 10 minutes. And as Claire Short isn't here, it gives us more time for you to speak. And I hope there will be plenty of time for debate. there are important differences in their understanding of what global society is. Each speaker will have 10 minutes exactly. I'm not going to let them go over time. They're looking at three particular questions. Is global civil society a counterweight to global capitalism? Is global civil society in danger of being co-opted? And is global civil society good or bad for democracy? We will end at 7:30, and our first speaker will be Salil Shetty, who is the Executive Director of ActionAid. Salil, thank you.
I started dragging my mic in advance to get that 30 seconds more, which you've given me. I was reading this morning the book which was released today, the Global Civil Society Handbook for 2001, and it took my mind back 10 years when I was at LSE studying here. And I must say that it's a very profound book, as Anna said, and people should read it. But at the end of it, I wasn't sure whether I actually work for a global civil society organization or not. And that sort of tells you about the degree of fuzziness, in a sense, around the word. And we couldn't possibly combine two more lethal words than civil society and globalization. So that is going to be the sort of the underlying text of my presentation. And the only way I could resolve it was by asking myself, what does it mean for organizations like ActionAid, international development NGOs? And for us, I think the question really is, what does global civil society mean in relation to the reality, the lives and realities of about 1/4 of the world's population who don't have food to eat, who are denied basic rights and denied security? And the answer, unfortunately, is not a very pleasant one. The answer is not enough. In fact, civil society in many countries, in my view, and I think in popular understanding as well, essentially are organized groups of people promoting their own self-interest. That's the popular perception of what civil society would be. And poor and marginalized people who are our concern, certainly ActionAid's concern, are not organized enough. They don't have a voice. There are a few exceptions at the local and national level, but certainly at the global level, which is what the discussion today is about, it's very, very weak. But our conception of civil society, in a sense, which is close to the ideal conception from our perspective, is one of poor and marginalized people protecting and promoting their own rights. It's tied in with people's own identities and their right to self-determination. It's tied into a much more endogenous, not autarkic, or not something which is cut off, but a much more internally driven model of development. And it challenges many of the existing inequalities and power relationships. In essence, it's full expression of citizenship in its broadest sense. So I wanted to lay out what it is that we are talking about from our perspective. But I think today's discussion is much more focused on a slightly narrower understanding of civil society in terms of civil society organizations, which is what we see, the visible part of global civil society, NGOs, churches, religious organizations, trade unions. Now, in spite of the limited direct voice of poor and marginalized people in this constituency, I think their contribution has been quite significant. The environment movement, women's movement, the campaigns on landmines, debt, and now on globalization have all been major victories, and would without doubt not have happened without the engagement, active engagement of global civil society organizations. Now, on globalization, which is essentially the current development model, if you want to sort of use a shortcut, I mean, I know that the word is loaded, but I'm just using it in that context right now. From our perspective, certainly, it's simply not delivering, even on its own terms. And particularly for sub-Saharan Africa and South Asia, or large parts of South Asia, where most poor people live, or where the depth of poverty is the greatest, it is simply not delivering. There are serious concerns that in spite of the best efforts from different people and different institutions, we continue to be pushing standardized models of development and a huge amount of double standards in the West on trade, with huge barriers, quotas, subsidies, all of which students and faculty of LSE are very familiar with, I'm sure. At the same time, we have falling aid levels and serious questions about the quality of aid and the extent to which aid really reaches poor people. Trade liberalization is seen as an end in itself. And I was very pleased. I was telling John earlier that a person who questioned this hard, Joseph Stiglitz, has been awarded the Nobel Prize. And most of all, I think our concern is that poor and marginalized people, again, are not... Poor and marginalized people are not at all in the debate. They are not. They are not seen as a core part.
Maybe you should come and use one of these.
It's okay. Is it okay? I think it's okay. So the question that was asked was: are global civil society organizations counterbalanced? Do we play a counterbalancing role? And I think the answer is a resounding yes. And I like the phrase which is used in one of the articles in the Global Civil Society Handbook, that organizations like ourselves have a key role and continue to play a key role in pushing for a globalization of rights and responsibilities, and not just of opening up of markets of poor countries. Many of the changes which require to be undertaken at this point in time are required at the global level and require action as much, if not more than, a global war as we are right now dealing with in relation to terrorism. Now, that was the first part of the discussion around capitalism, on globalization. Moving on to democracy. Now, in our conception, a global civil society, is it good or bad for democracies is not the right question. In a sense, it is popular participatory democracy. And it is not counterposed to the state. And it's not counterposed, but it's... It's not the substance of what I'm saying which is causing the static. I'm told that LSE kind of has moved on over the decades, so I'm not sure where the average barometer of thinking is right now. But certainly, I think on the question of democracy, the role of global civil society, again, is very central.
It's a subtle form of censorship.
At the national level, just to give you some examples, and I'm sure many of you are familiar with it, some very important initiatives have been undertaken, like report cards, essentially examples of pushing for public accountability, participatory budgeting. ActionAid's been involved in citizens' juries in Brazil and India recently on the whole question of GM technology and what does it mean to farmers, the extent to which farmers can take decisions themselves as to whether they want to use GM crops or not. But at the international level, so it's essentially, I would say that the process of deliberative democracy is the sort of role which civil society organizations are pushing through at the national level. But at the international level, one of the roles which global civil society has played very effectively is to step in when national level civil society organizations are unable to deal with issues. And there was a recent case, I think in Egypt, where some of the national level regulation was actually beginning to curb civil liberties and certainly beginning to curb civil society space at the national level. But the intervention of some international organizations has been very, very successful. Equally, I think on the whole question of global governance, many of the global institutions like the WTO, which is the oft-quoted one, or the IMF, the bank, there are serious questions about the degree to which they are accountable publicly. And so the push from global civil society organizations on making global institutions more accountable is a central role which they continue to play. And we cannot forget that all this is happening in the context, rather unfortunately, where mainstream political processes, even in the West, are beginning to lose ground. I can say it a little more boldly now that Claire Short is not around. But certainly I think there is a high degree of disillusionment, especially amongst younger people. And the numbers are incredible. I mean, ActionAid, for example, has 500,000 supporters across Europe right now. And many political parties don't have that kind of a supporter base. And we know the stories of Germany and the environment movement and how that's changed the membership base entirely. In the US, surveys conducted have shown that NGOs or civil society organizations have greater credibility. Surveys conducted by independent market research organizations have shown that NGO reports, civil society reports have greater credibility than reports published by governments or corporations. And today, in the context of the Afghan crisis, we've seen that civil society organizations are playing a very central role, particularly where many of us as individuals feel that our governments are not taking positions which we subscribe to. Now, I can certainly say that in relation to the Indian government, which is where I come from, but I think many of the Afghani people or many people in this country would hold that view as well. And there's a real risk we've seen, which civil society organizations are keeping a very careful watch on, of opportunistic action in this context. There's a sort of steady push now to push through some trade liberalization agendas around Doha and the next round of WTO negotiations. Because of the current context, things are, an attempt is being made to push through. So the role of global civil society organizations, again, is very central in this process. I want to just mention one thing before closing, Anna, which is that, I was going to say this, I'm saying this in spite of Claire's absence, because I think it's very important, and she would, I'm sure, have made this point about the question of the legitimacy of global civil society organizations and our own internal accountability. If we are holding public institutions accountable, or we claim to, how much are we accountable internally? I think there is a problem of many organizations who are in the civic sector being self-referential, and accountability to poor and marginalized people of our own organization is weak. There is a temptation very often to do short bursts of campaigning in order to grab profile. The quality of analysis sometimes is weak, and very often we lack providing affirmative positive agenda. So this is all true, and I think those are things which we ourselves need to work on. But to close, I think whichever way we define civil society, and whether we look at it in the context of capitalism or globalization or democracy, I think civil society is a permanent and central part of the new world order in whatever shape it takes. Thank you.
Sorry, thank you. And now John Clark, who is former head of the NGO Civil Society Unit at the World Bank, and he's now a visiting fellow here. John.
Thank you, Anna. I'm actually standing in for Mats Karlsson, the Vice President for External Relations in the World Bank, who apologizes that he's not going to be able to be here. He actually asked me to stand in for him, not, I think, because he feels that I would represent the World Bank and its views as well as he does. I'm something of a maverick within the organization, but because he knows that I'm writing a book on much of the ground that we're covering here today. In response to the three questions, is global civil society a counterweight to global capitalism? Yes. Is global civil society in danger of being co-opted? No. Is global civil society good or bad for democracy? It depends. Now, I think I've got a little bit more time to elaborate on those answers. But before I do that, I wanted to say just a little bit about what I think, what I understand by globalization. At its most broadest level, globalization is about dismantling the barriers to human interaction across national boundaries. And in that sense, it's quite neutral. It breaks down, though, into different components of globalization. You have social globalization. You have cultural globalization. You have interactions between people. You have political globalization. And you have economic globalization. And of course, it's economic globalization that tends to be the controversial area. You even have globalization of protest and of resistance. It's interesting that one of the lead organizations in terms of getting people out on the streets at the times of big protests, certainly in the UK, is called globalized resistance. So that in itself is a manifestation of globalization. In itself, economic globalization needs to be parsed into the different components. Economic globalization is essentially about freeing markets from regulations and from restrictions. But as students of economists know, and I suspect there are one or two here today, there are many markets. There are markets in primary commodities, there are markets in manufactured goods, there are markets in services, there's markets in foreign direct investment, in short-term capital, in intellectual property. There are markets in basic labor, and there are markets in highly skilled labor. And I think the essence of the controversy surrounding globalization is that there is such inequity in the way in which there is liberalization and change within those markets. Inequity which leads some, the owners of intellectual property, the owners of capital, to do very nicely as a result of the changes, whilst those who depend on others, particularly basic labour or agricultural commodities, do so poorly. So the concerns about globalisation, and in a way we need to get away from globalisation is good or bad, that's a sterile debate. The questions are whether globalisation serves the interests of those who are making the rules about globalisation, whether it is indeed widening inequalities of wealth, of power, access to technology, both within nations and between nations, and whether it is increasing the risks that we face in our daily lives, risks due to banking crises, currency crises, unemployment, the risk of unemployment, the potential for disease, including GM-related disease, climatic concerns, concerns to do with global warming, concerns to do with conflict. Are these, in effect, manifestations of the way in which globalization is being managed in today's world? About 12 years ago, I wrote a paper in which I described the world of global economics as being rather like a big game of Monopoly, in which certain players, countries, start with hotels on Mayfair and Park Lane, and other countries have nothing but Old Kent Road. And in a way, the same is true today, except some players have two or three hotels on Park Lane, and Old Kent Road has been mortgaged. Now, I want to say a quick word about the World Bank. I mean, I think the World Bank has been very much criticized by those who are concerned about the way globalization is being managed. And there is some justification for that, and I'm not here to defend the institution. But I think that also there are areas in which those informed critics of globalization have actually much to gain by looking for potential synergies with what the World Bank and some within the World Bank are saying. Probably the World Bank, amongst the big institutions, is the one that is most saying that we live in a world in which the playing field is far from level. Colleagues of mine in the World Bank did a rough calculation about the cost to the developing nations of the current restrictions due to tariff barriers, non-tariff barriers, protection in services, the manipulation of intellectual property, and calculate that the cost of all of this combined to the South comes to $186 billion per year, which is four times the level of aid. So I think that there's potential for agreement as well as disagreement. Now to the actual questions. Civil society is a counterweight to global capitalism. For the reasons I've answered, yes, and thank God it is. It is NGOs, trade unions, citizens groups around the world who are raising the sorts of issues that I'm talking about. Now, I'd say that they're not always raised constructively. Sometimes the facts and information that is given is highly distorted, often inaccurate. My major concern is that sometimes the ain't it awful is there, but the pathway to a new future is not so clear. The lack of alternatives, I think, is a critically important problem. But I think it is very doubtful whether the issues would be so high on the agenda as they are today had it not been for civil society doing what they can to put them there. Is civil society in danger of being co-opted? Well, I think the question is a little bit misleading because it implies that civil society is a homogeneous sector. It isn't. It is a sector. It's like the private sector. There are good firms and bad firms and rogue firms and huge firms and little firms. Civil society is the same. And its strength is that diversity. There are some within civil society who will do nothing other than mobilize street demonstrations. There are some who will do nothing other than lobby for specific policy changes. And there are some who seek opportunities to really engage with the decision policy makers and so on. And there are others who will take money from whatever aid agency cares to give it. So there is that diversity. But one thing which is interesting, I think, is that the manifestations of street protest and so on, there is tension, obviously, within civil society because of the different strategies. But one of the things which is interesting is the way in which the street demonstrations, the public manifestations, by putting issues so high on the agenda, are actually opening up space in which those who seek to engage can do so with more potency. And it is necessary to do that, because to achieve real change in the world requires change in public attitudes, changes in public policies, and changes in public institutions. And you can't have that without engagement. The final question is, global civil society good or bad for democracy? Well, I think that's the wrong question. The question I'd like to answer is today's globalizing world good or bad for democracy as we know it? And democracy is under fire. It, as Salil has said, it's become a little bit, the party, traditional party divides seem to have got a bit jaded, a bit unpopular, failing to capture the public mood. The fault lines, somehow the party divides no longer seem to reflect the fault lines of political contention. And most particularly for today's debate, there is the question of reach. Decisions that affect our lives are increasingly made not in national governments, but in regional or global forums, in transnational corporations, where traditional democracy does not reach. Now, civil society can undermine the weaknesses that are inherent in democracy. They can help to atomize political discourse into 1,001 separate interest groups. They can sort of stand in and assert themselves as being the voice of people in fora in which there is not yet a coherent mechanism to have that voice. But they can, by being responsible and by working with responsible media and responsible governments, help to build a more democratic global tomorrow. There's a lot of discussion about the global financial architecture. What civil society acting globally can do is to inject a quotient of democracy, citizens' accountability, transparency, and responsibility in this. Can I just close with just one quick reflection about the events of September 11th? As you've said, Anna, it is indescribably horrible what has happened, but it has helped to highlight the seismic fault lines that exist in politics today. The dangerous inequalities of power and wealth, the dangerous flashpoints such as West Bank and Gaza, the dangerous breakdowns in communications between cultures. These things need to be addressed. Yes, we need to take tough action on the present terrorism, but the motto should be tough on terrorism, tough on the causes of terrorism. Civil society could help to respond to this. There's every war spawns a new sort of language, and the term that we hear a lot of today is military assets. What we also need is reconciliation assets, and civil society could help to be just that. Thank you.
Thank you. John, thank you very much, and thank you very much for standing in for Mats as well. I'm not sure why he couldn't be here, but I don't think it was the same reason as Claire Short. And now Jessica Woodroffe, who is head of campaigns at the World Development Movement. Jessica, could you tell us exactly what that is? Because I think some people may not know. Thank you.
The World Development Movement is a UK-based advocacy organisation. We don't fund parties now. We solely do campaigning in this country on issues of economic justice, on issues around trade and on debt. And I'm sure you're all disappointed that Claire Short isn't here today, probably not quite as disappointed as I am, because when I was asked to come and do this, I'd just come back from avoiding being tear gassed in Genoa, to find that Claire Short was criticising myself and the many other people who'd gone to Genoa and saying it was an irresponsible use of our time and money. In fact, following comments that I'd made on the Today programme along with a colleague from Oxfam, she described us as nice, young, and well-meaning. I'm not that young, I'm quite nice and well-meaning, but that really wasn't the point. And I would love to have been able to talk with her this evening about just how wrong it is for government ministers to tell those of us as citizens who want to protest how, when, and what we can say. It's a lot easier to say that when she's not here. I'd like to divide my comments into three areas. The first is on the nature of global civil society. Does it exist and is it a useful concept? The second is these issues around the role of global civil society in democratizing globalization. And the third, if it's not too cheeky, on whether this debate is useful. But starting with the first question on what is global civil society, is it a useful thing? And I question whether there's even such a thing as homogeneous civil society in the UK, let alone globally. And in the authors have put in this book that civil society is fuzzy. I'd say it was a lot more than fuzzy. It's fragmented. It's deeply and inevitably fragmented. And I think there's a danger here when we talk about global civil society that we're obscuring some of the very fundamental conflicts and power that there are within society. Just to give you some examples, within the organisations that we call civil society are organisations who classify themselves as pro-choice, women's right to choose over whether to have an abortion, and there are others who are virulently anti-abortion. There are organisations in civil society that use very different methods. So there are some who believe in parliamentary systems, and there are some who are working outside the parliamentary system. And again, coming back to Genoa, one of the things that I heard about, although I didn't actually witness it, was some of the violent protesters turning on some of the pacifists within the same demonstration. It's very difficult to talk about the global civil society when you've witnessed that. And I think the third thing is that the people's perceptions of democracy as civil society organizations are very different. So I think one of the things that we've witnessed is that some civil society movements, and perhaps the DEC campaign is an example of this, have actually grown in strength because they think they do have access to decision makers, because they think there's some point in protesting. Whereas we're also increasingly, and very importantly, seeing a rise in movements in global civil society because they feel completely marginalized, either because they feel that multinationals rather than governments are actually taking decisions, or because they feel that international institutions, whether it be the World Bank, the IMF, or the World Trade Organization, are taking decisions, and again, they have no access to them. But so with that caveat about whether it's a useful term, if we think about, is there something different happening? And it may be more useful, rather than saying, is there an increase in global civil society, to say there are strands, north and south, among civil society that share common political perceptions. And is there an increasing interconnectedness between them? And this, I think, is important, is that the way I see globalization is in two ways, partly as an increasing interconnectedness, communication, benign. And there is undoubtedly that increasing communication, north and south, between civil society organizations. But then there's the second thing that's happening under globalization, and that is the political choice, the political ideology of liberalization being exported from north to south. And what I think is also interesting is that in some ways that has brought with it a convergence of civil society organizations, because increasingly, wherever you live, you're facing the same problems. Now, of course, they don't have the same effect on you. If you're a rich person in the north, globalization has a different impact than if you're a poor person in the south, but crudely. But we are seeing the same institutions, like the World Trade Organization, influencing all of our lives wherever we live. And I do think that, in a certain way, is bringing together protest movements. One of the things I think is also important to recognize, and this is something that the World Development Movement did some work on, is that protests about globalization, about liberalization, happened long before the pictures that you will have seen, some of you may have been, in Seattle. But one of the things that we've documented is the many thousands of protests that have taken place all over the South about liberalization. And I think it's a shame if we see the protest in Seattle as the kind of start of a new movement, because that new movement was already there. Perhaps what we did see at the Seattle demonstrations around the World Trade Organization ministerial was some recognition by an increasing number of people in the North that these things were happening to them too, not just to people in the South. The other thing I think we've seen happening, and I'm going to talk very much for a minute from my own personal experience, because I work for a non-government organization. I think one of the mistakes is that NGOs, non-government organizations, think that they are civil society. We are just one small part of civil society. Trade unions, consumer groups, indigenous groups, all sorts of groups form civil society. But if just simply talking about my own experience and working for a development NGO, I think one of the things that we've seen is a shift from NGOs as service providers to NGOs who advocated on behalf of people in the South, to NGOs who realized that they needed to advocate with people in the South, and increasingly a recognition that actually we should be supporting Southern advocacy. And I think that shift in analysis in the UK is going alongside what's happening with globalization. But again, it's by no means monolithic. And I've had some of the NGOs in, well, particularly one in Ghana, describing to me how his organization felt that increasingly NGOs in the UK were using his organization to collect stories. Rather than really listening to what they were saying, they were providing the images, the photographs, the colorful stories. But on the other hand, I've had, similarly actually in Ghana, colleagues saying to me, you know your political context, you've listened to us, we trust you. Stop coming back and asking us what you should think every 5 minutes. Just go away and do it. And so I think what we've got there is a whole variety of relationships. But so I think there probably has been an increase in the connection of protesters. But the connection started long before Seattle. And what you've seen in demonstrations in Seattle in general is not what it's all about. What it's all about is people demonstrating in their own countries, but understanding much better about what each other's saying. To a certain extent, I think you're getting a conversion of economic systems and therefore a conversion of resistance. I think we can see all these splits among civil society as a weakness, as fragmentation, but we could look at it the other way around. And one of the things we're often criticized by Claire Short and others is that we have no single message. But look at it the other way around. Given the diversity of civil society, isn't it amazing that we're even managing to talk to each other at all sometimes? And it's messy, but that's how it works. So the role of civil society organizations in democratizing globalization, the second point. And of course, it partly depends about which organizations are we talking about. But whichever ones we're talking about, I think one of the dangers has been that the role of NGOs in standing up to multinationals has been grossly overstated. And the idea that groups of NGOs are and should be the people who regulate multinational activities is ridiculous, I think. We can do something to raise the issues, raise the problems, let people know what's happening, but ultimately it has to be governments who, under globalization, where we're seeing increasing power of multinationals, it has to be governments who ultimately regulate them. And my concern is that the UK government and others have actually in some ways used NGOs to let them off the hook, to say it's okay, these NGOs are monitoring the activities of multinationals, so we don't need to do anything. So do NGOs have a role? And clearly they do. They've got a role in holding governments to account. That's what we should be doing. We're groups of citizens and we should be holding our governments to account. And in the case of the work that I do, we should be holding our governments to account to ensure that multinationals are held to account. Very briefly on co-option, and there is a dangerous trend that governments are picking and choosing which NGOs they talk to and are spending too much time legitimizing some and delegitimizing others. It's understandable, of course you do that. Why give floor space to your critics? But it's a dangerous trend. So I think NGOs can only ever have a very limited role in holding multinationals to account and therefore in democratizing globalization. Ultimately, it has to be governments. Clearly, in a healthy democracy, dissent is vital. And if NGOs stop voicing concerns and become mere government advisors, as some do, then our society will be the poorer. I think there's a third element here that, again, is partly related to what Claire Short would have said, but I think it's very important to recognize that it's actually desirable for those of us who are privileged to support the voices of those who are not. one of the things that Claire did was criticise what she termed as anti-globalisation protesters, although that were not, but to criticise those of us who want to speak with people in the South as speaking not on our own issues, not in our own interest. But surely that's incredibly important, that those of us who do have more access to power do speak with others and echo their voices. And so finally, is the debate a useful one? And I think the problem is potentially no, because one of the things that both the UK government and the World Bank does is try to delegitimise what we're saying by questioning our legitimacy to exist. And I really don't think our legitimacy to exist is the most important thing at the moment to talk about. Now, particularly coming from a world development movement perspective, we only ever say that we speak on behalf of our members. We don't profess to speak on behalf of people in the South. But it's if the government and others disagree with the content of what is being said, they should argue about the content. And there's a real danger that by talking too much about civil society organisations, we forget about the content of the message and start talking about our own legitimacy. Of course, we ought to examine what we say, what right we have to say, and so on. But in my experience, NGOs spend far too much time navel-gazing, and that really isn't our problem. Where the debate, I think, is helpful is if it does help us recognise what our role should be, who we speak on behalf of, and make sure that we do listen to others. But I think where it may also be helpful is if it starts persuading decision makers to recognise that we are a diverse group of people and that they have to listen more carefully to what we have to say. Of course, it's our responsibility to communicate, but it's their responsibility to listen. And perhaps I've got previous permission of the organisers, I can just sum up with a plug for an event that we're doing about the issue that we work on, which is called Free Trade, Trick or Treat for the World's Poor. Campaigners are never allowed to miss an opportunity, so it was me using mine. Saturday the 3rd of November, between 6 and 8 at the Westminster Central Hall, WGM's organising debate, including Naomi Klein and other speakers on free trade. We welcome Claire Shaw if she felt like coming in too.
Thank you very much for that commercial break. Thanks, Jessica. Tony Giddens has arrived. Do you want to say anything now or later? Sorry, he's not standing at all. Fine. Well, all right, it's your turn. So many issues raised, it's hard to... I'm not going to even attempt to pull them all together, and I don't want to interfere in your time for speaking, but maybe you'd like to ask some questions of the people on the panel. We also have Marlies Glacius, who is the editor of the Civil Society Yearbook, and, of course, Mary Caldor, who is the director of the centre here at the LSE. Any questions or any points that you want to make on any of those issues? Yes, over here. Will you give us your name? Those of you who speak will be brought a microphone.
I like John Clark's line about tough on terrorism, tough on the causes of terrorism. And I see being tough on terrorism happening now, but I don't see being tough on terrorism.
They can't hear you upstairs. I think your microphone may not be switched on.
I liked your line about tough on terrorism, tough on the causes, and I see us being tough on terrorism now, but not doing a whole lot about the causes. So what's the panel got to say about our being tough on the causes?
Could we have a note from the panel on being tough on the causes of terrorism? What is how and... John, would you like to go first?
Yeah, sure. I'm sure probably all of us have been in Palestinian refugee camps. I know in my time in Gaza, one of the things that became really very clear to me is the very evident to me was the sense of utter futility, utter anger with the world, which allows people to live for decades in the sorts of situation of little hope that you see in a situation like the West Bank and Gaza. So I don't think I would ever begin to guess what works in the mind of a bin Laden, but I can get a sense, I think, for what works in the minds of people who have lived for 20 years in a crowded, oppressive refugee camp and have nothing to look forward to other than more decades of the same. And I suppose that is, I'm saying that to understand what it is that creates breeding grounds for the sorts of people who will take desperate measures. George Bush said something to the effect of the terrorists who hate our freedom. I don't think that is a measure of where young people who hate the United States are coming from. What it is a deep resentment of the sense, however wrong it is, that that freedom is at the expense of their own. So I, you know, why I think that civil society is so critically important to addressing these things and what being tough on the causes of terrorism means is relentless advocacy to resolve those flashpoints like the West Bank and Gaza, as well as real people-to-people conduits, faith-to-faith understanding, advocates of humanitarian agenda, and ambassadors for understanding. So this is basically what I'm saying.
Salio, how would you deal with terrorism?
Well, fortunately, we're not in that business. But I think, certainly we all know in a sense. Our concern is that we are in a state, in a world today where we know more or less what the issues are, and we know that if we have the will to solve it, in relation to poverty, certainly, we have the resources, we have the understanding, we have the knowledge with us to address it if we want to do it. But we set international development targets, which are always 20, 30 years away, and then we keep pushing it forward and forward. Certainly in relation to places like Burundi or Rwanda, Central Africa, many of these places, we know that there is a relationship between poverty and conflict. Terrorism is a slightly different story, and I'm not going to try and draw any kind of correlations between terrorism, inequality, conflict, because I think we're going into rather dangerous territory there. But certainly we know that many of these countries have been pawns on a kind of a chessboard of global superpowers. And I mean, we can't ignore the history of why these countries have reached the situation they're in. So.
One of the difficulties, surely, is that the Americans seem to find it profoundly difficult, including Pulitzer Prize winners and relatively sophisticated networking ex-American ambassadors, who find it very difficult to understand recently why America is so hated, and have put up their hands saying it must be because we're so successful that people envy us. That sort of profound lack of understanding surely says a great deal about how far we have to go. Jessica? No, right. Shall I take a bundle of questions from people and then put them all at the same time, or do people want to make points? I don't want you to feel that you're completely dumb, because there are a lot of you here, and I know how frustrating it can be to be in an audience and not be able to speak. A question or a statement? Okay, I'll take a question, then I'll take another question, and then I'll take another question, and then we'll put them all together. I think that's the best way to handle it.
My question is in the...
Who are you?
Sorry, I'm... my name's Daniel Ben-Ami, and I'm a journalist. My question is that in the light of the events of September the 11th and also the month that's gone by since then, should we rethink our attitude about the relationship between global capitalism or the global corporations and the state? And very briefly, the reason I ask the question is before that, it seemed to me to be very fashionable to talk about how the state was becoming weaker and weaker. You know, there was a silent takeover. It was a captive state. Somehow the weak state had become captive to the multinational corporation. Whereas in the month since then, we've seen state power in incredible forms, not just military, but diplomatic and political and so on. So maybe we should be thinking, rethinking it, saying the state actually is pretty powerful and maybe is actually a problem for the people in the south and the people in the north. I mean, someone mentioned a million Iraqis being killed in the past decade as a result of Western intervention. You know, maybe the state is more of a problem than the corporation. Maybe shouldn't we consider that?
Good, fine. One question. Another question over here. Fine, yes, and then a question up in the gallery.
Carol Tung, former MEP and at the moment, with one of my hats on, a member of a European Union high-level group on cultural diversity. I have to say, a debate that's often forgotten in this country whilst we concentrate on social, environmental and labour issues and we forget the issues of global cultural diversity. But my question, in fact, is to the panellists. Given that the time is ripe for changing the institutions of world governance, how do you and your organisations actually practically plan to influence nation-state governments at the government of the United Kingdom through the DTI, through the Treasury, and the Department for International Development, because it is those three departments who will be now or not sitting there deciding what they'd like the WTO, the World Bank, or the IMF to look like. And Anna, just finally, I think many of us will have heard women from the Afghan Women's Liberation Movement appealing to us on Women's Hour this week for a secular state. It may seem a great ideal. How are we going to help women like them have any say whatsoever in any future government in Afghanistan?
Fine, thank you. And a question in the gallery from...
Thanks. Robert Wade. I'm sure that just about everybody in this room is convinced that the tremendous growth in the power and influence of NGOs in the world at large over the past 30 years or so is a very strongly positive force in the world polity, and that it complements, it reinforces democratization. I want to introduce a note of skepticism and maybe ask one or two of the panel to respond. It seems to me that there is a real, at one level at least, there is a real tension between the growth of NGOs on the one hand and democracy on the other. And you see this tension in the case of when a political party calls a meeting and nobody turns up. Why? Because the activists are all at meetings of NGOs. The point is that NGOs are necessarily single interest organizations and therefore intrinsically divisive. That is to say, each NGO does not have to consider how its demands can be reconciled with, can be aggregated with, the demands of other groups, other interests in the society. The kinds of institutions and organizations that do that reconciling, that aggregation, that forming of priorities are political parties. And it seems to me a cause of great worry that political parties have, across the Western world, become quite weak organizations. And I think that that is directly related to the ascendancy of NGOs. We have several people on the panel who are speaking on behalf of NGOs, and I wonder how you would respond.
Fine. Three good questions. Thank you very much. John, would you like to answer? Did you manage to get them down?
Yes, indeed. Yeah.
Fine. The first one about state power versus NGO power. Is it state power that should be worrying about?
I agree with the thrust of the question that I think that there is now a greater argument for saying that cautious state intervention in markets, in market mechanisms, is important. I mean, of course, there's always been state intervention in markets. So the notion that governments should get out of markets, except for when there's a political interest to be had in protecting British farmers or textile workers or European producers of certain commodities. There are all sorts of exceptions to the rule about not intervening in markets. I suppose now what I think September 11th has revealed is the fact that there are some, as I mentioned earlier, dangerous fracture lines in global politics. And that, in particular, the massive and rapidly growing inequality of wealth and of power is something which is leading to greater dangers, and that is there is therefore, in the same way as I think European democracies did do a reasonable job in the middle part of the last century in saying that we need to redress the considerable inequalities between rich and poor at the national level, and progressive taxation was a response to that, as well as national health system and so on. I mean, I think that there is now the need for a very deliberate redistributive policy, redistributing both power and wealth. If you look at an institution like the World Trade Organization, on the one hand, it is a very equitable institution, 143 members, each of which has a single vote, no vote bigger than any other. Each actually has a veto power, and yet the way in which the disputes mechanism of the WTO operates is clearly highly loaded. Just saw a statistic today. There were something like 228 complaints registered with the WTO as of March this year. Of those, not a single one had been registered from a member of the least developed country, and about 170 of them were from the OECD countries. Now, is that because the poorest countries on earth feel that trade is completely fair? Of course it's not. It's that they know that in order to take a complaint through the WTO is going to be so incredibly expensive in terms of the legal fees and so on that are involved, that they just don't risk it. And they also know that the panel to which they'll have to answer is largely going to be comprised of representatives financed by northern governments. So you know, I think that we really do have, in the interests of global security, if not anything to do with inherent justice, there are very important arguments now for saying we need to tackle as a top global priority inequities in power and wealth. I think another point.
Well, can we move on? I mean, can I ask Salil if he has an answer? Because
I assume we're talking about the state versus corporate power question.
It was, I'm sorry, I said NGO.
No, but I think the concern is, in fact, quite the opposite. I think that, I think the example of Italy is probably the most extreme one. You know, the worry is that some states are being, when you say states, I mean governments in power have actually been bankrolled into coming into power in some places. And we have now in Italy a situation where some of the rules of the game are being changed, because we have the person who's heading the country also happens to, you know, benefit from some of these rules. So we are worried that when, I mean, in the current situation, I would say that the reason why there's been the coming together of interests is because the corporate interests and state interests in this case are coming together. The problem is if they don't come together, and I cannot imagine many governments today who can stand up and say no to the largest of the corporations. And of course there are states and states, you know, just like we said, civil society. We can't generalize about governments, but certainly in many developing countries which are small and weak governments, I mean, I think the big multinational corporations have a very large say in how they make decisions.
Have you got something to say? Yes. I'll come back to you in a moment. Yes.
To be honest, I think it's a very odd question, because what we've certainly seen states acting as states in terms of security over the last month, we've seen nothing to do with states acting to stand up to multinationals over the last month. And while it's obviously incredibly important to talk about not what happened on September 11, but people's response to it, it does seem to me a shame that the hundreds of thousands of people whose lives are every day affected adversely by trade liberalisation, by the dominance of multinationals, do go unnoticed. And what's happened since September 11th has not made a difference to that. The state is not demonstrating responsibility in terms of regulating markets in favour of the poor.
Do you want to come back?
I can.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, very briefly, the reason I asked the question is it does seem to me that, not that things have fundamentally changed in that sense over the past month, but more that I think the debate went too far in terms of seeing the state, you know, the captive state, the title of a popular book at the moment, but that sums up the idea, that the state was somehow kind of weak and enfeebled and dominated by these multinational corporations. I certainly take the point that we're talking about a different situation in the third world to the West, But I think when you're talking about Western states, you're talking about incredibly powerful institutions. And so when we start talking about new forms of state regulation, which essentially I think is what Jessica is talking about, I think we should be very, very careful about that. We should be nervous about what the state is capable of, what it can do to its own citizens, and what it can do to people in the South.
Fine, thank you. Can we move on to the question from Carol Tong over here? Just, and can you be quite brief, otherwise we won't get through anything. Perhaps. Okay. I'd particularly like to pick up your question about women. How can we help women have a part in, women from those particular states that she was talking about, have any part in the discussions that are going on? Salil.
I mean, we have actually, it doesn't work in Afghanistan, so I can't give you a specific answer about Afghanistan. But the core of my presentation was around this question of how do we have people who are actually affected directly involved in the decision making, and this is a big gap in the discourse today. And I was focusing on poor and marginalized people, but a lot of those people are women in the first place. I mean, the Afghan case is an extreme case, and I think. I don't have a specific answers to what we can do in relation to, I mean, I heard the program and I know it's a big concern right now. But we are not specifically working, so Anna, I might not be the right person to answer.
Jessica.
I was actually going to answer the other part of the question.
All right, do you want to answer the other?
Well, just, you asked about what NGOs were planning to do to influence the World Bank, the World Trade Organization and the International Monetary Fund through our government, which is in fact all that we do. And so I won't go into details about what we do. But I think one of the key things that you said is how do we plan to influence those institutions through our governments? And I do think that's very important, that as the UK is represented in those institutions by our governments, and that's the way to influence them. And just a reminder again that on November 3rd, there is this trade justice movement carnival ending in meetings in the evening. Which is trying to do precisely that, trying to shift the political agenda, the political debate around trade liberalisation, questioning what the Department of Trade and Industry is doing in relation to the World Trade Organization when they're meeting Qatar.
And what about the final question about the weakness of political parties?
I don't know, I mean, whether there was a slight, there's a question as to whether we got sort of cause and effect chain slightly mixed up on that. I mean, I think certainly that if political parties were delivering, we wouldn't be seeing such growth in our membership. And I hope that, I do feel that it is a negative phenomenon. I feel that the mainstream political processes should be strengthened, and NGOs are not meant to be substituting either mainstream political parties or the state as service deliverers. So, I mean, it is not a healthy trend, but it's a reality, and I think it's a mix-up between the cause and the consequence there.
John.
I agree with Salil. I think that the, to some extent, the political party process has emerged as being slightly anachronistic, and when the big political divides were on the issues about the ownership of means of production and whether the state should deliver any services to the people, then the 2-3-4 political party process might have been a good mechanism for that. But now politics is so much more fragmented into a number of interests to do with what is produced, for what sort of society, and who controls it, and what are the consequences of these actions, that it does perhaps more get taken up, more reflected by the growing number of individual pressure groups. As Salil said, though, I think that this can actually help to enforce and reinvigorate democracy rather than undermine it.
One of the problems with not having Claire Short here is, of course, that we've not had the sort of dissident voice that we might have expected. Can I take, you wanted to say something, didn't you?
Thanks. Chris Brown, International Relations Department, LSE. I guess mine's a statement, but I'll put "do you agree" at the end, and you can call it a question if you like. I got a sense earlier that the panel was coming to a consensus that the world hates the United States, and rightly so. And I think that's wrong. The world doesn't hate the United States, and I think it would be wrong if it did. I think the world has a love-hate relationship with the United States. Tens and hundreds of millions of people actually want to go and work in the United States. All over the world, people watch American television, MTV, they wear T-shirts, they wear American jeans, they eat American food, drink American drinks. That doesn't look to me like a straightforward hatred. I think love-hate possibly, but not hatred. So I think that rhetoric is not very helpful. It's also misleading.
Sorry, I only used it because that was the rhetoric being used 4 weeks ago.
But it wasn't you, it was the other members of the panel. The other reason it's unhelpful is because it overstates the role of the United States within the current global system. I mean, clearly the United States is the most important state, and American corporations are the most important corporations, but I don't think that's how the world works anywhere anymore. If globalization means anything, it means that no one state is controlling the deal. It means that maybe the United States has more influence than most, but it doesn't have that kind of control. You then ask, well, why is it that people sometimes pretend it does? And of course, one of the reasons is because it suits very much the interests of the West Europeans that the world should think of the world like that. I mean, a good question would be, what have the West Europeans, the Brits, the Germans, and the French done for the Palestinians in Gaza? When did we on this side of the Atlantic propose more globally just international institutions? It serves the interests of people in Europe a lot to suggest the United States is the sole block in the on the roadmap towards a just world. Quite a lot of times, this is very obvious when, for example, people talk about forgiving debt, and the European and British governments all say, we can't possibly do this unless the United States does as well. And the obvious question is, well, why not? That's something one could do unilaterally. So I think often hatred of the United States is seen as a kind of alibi, and it misunderstands the nature of the global system. Read Tony Negri's recent book, or read Tony Giddens' book on this, and you wouldn't believe, I think, that single countries have that kind of power. Do you agree?
Thanks very much. I'll just take some more points from the floor because the panel had a big bite. Yes, one here. Up here. Yes, you were first. Take you first, and then I'll come down here.
Sorry, that's a good way of announcing myself. My name's Fanny Calder. I work for the Royal Institute of International Affairs, and I am one of the co-opted. I used to work for Greenpeace. And I'm very interested, actually, having worked for a lot of NGOs and now working very closely with NGOs, government, and industry, in the way, the sort of ecology of the relationships between these three groups, it's crudely put to put them as three groups, but I think we can talk of them as three groups, is evolving. I think that we've talked a lot about the need not to say that NGOs are a homogenous group. I think we need to say the same of business. I think to say that business is purely, purely self-interested is no longer the case. I think that there's a lot of interesting things happening, particularly in multinationals. And the way that this is evolving is through, a lot of the times, through interesting partnerships between NGOs, government, and business. And I'm not sure, I don't want to go into this in too much detail, but for instance, at the moment, I'm working on a project with the tourism industry in the UK. The whole of the industry is involved. Nobody's really forced them into it, but they're actually looking at themselves and saying, we know we're going to have to change. We know that we're really at the sort of right at the forefront of globalization because we are going to places where there are poor people. At the moment, we're not spreading many benefits to them. And they're really turning to NGOs and to the UK government and saying, what can policy do and what can NGO expertise do to help us change this? So I'm interested in what the panel think of those kind of models and of the fact that I'm not saying that corporations are a good thing homogeneously, but that there is a real opportunity. And I think it's an opportunity that exists now, and if it's not taken, may go, to actually take on this corporate social responsibility agenda and really make something real, get some real change out of it. So I'd be interested in your views. I also wanted to say something about the World Summit for Sustainable Development that nobody has mentioned yet tonight. This is Rio plus 10. It's 10 years on from Rio. And it's something that I think is not getting much attention from the media or from NGOs at the moment, but is an incredible opportunity. Tony Blair has said that he'll go. No other head of state has said that they'll go yet. But what the sort of debate that's going on in the EU and in South Africa, where the summit's going to be held, is about some kind of new global deal, which actually would be between these three groups, between NGOs, business and government, to start really looking at how we can deliver on some of the promises that were made at Rio and that really haven't been met. And the last thing to say about that is that the final day of WSSD is September the 11th next year, so there's obviously massive symbolic opportunities there, given that the Prime Minister has said, you know, that we need a new global deal following September the 11th. I'd be very interested in people's thoughts on how we can kind of harness this political opportunity.
Thank you. I'm going to take point here, point there, and then there was somebody over here. Yes. And then we'll see what the time is.
My name is Aisha Fairley and I'm a journalist too.
Who do you work for?
Financial Times Business.
Thank you.
Within the context of globalization, it's always argued nowadays that the power of states is eroded by two forces, mainly the so-called international financial institutions, be it the World Bank or the IMF on the one hand, and the multinational corporations on the other. And it's also argued that these are not accountable to citizens and they are not as legitimate as the so-called elected governments. But in a world where there is a lower voter turnout and lack of interest in politics, do you think the role of NGOs, for example, could be to make these more accountable in the eyes of the citizens through, especially as Ms. Woodford pointed out, through the involvement of governments, and particularly if these governments are being selective in whom they speak to? Could you please answer that? Thank you.
Thank you. Behind you.
My name's Lynn Jones and I work for a medical NGO in the Balkans. I wanted to come back to what you were saying about the diversity of civil society and the fact that it wasn't always accountable and the complexity of it. And I think that actually perhaps is one of the most important issues to address, although you said at the end it's not important. If we recognise that...
Could you hold the microphone a bit nearer?
Sorry, do I need to repeat any of that? Was that no. Well, I'll just carry on. Terrorism is a manifestation of civil society in action, and I think we have to acknowledge that. It's not the action of states, it's the action of civil society, expressed in a way we might not approve of or like, but we can't get away from that. And therefore, how we talk to each other, how we deal with our different ways of confronting problems when they arise, how we cross the dialogue of cultures, religions, is really the question of how you globalize civil society. And I don't know if it's possible, but I wanted to bring up one mechanism that nobody's mentioned and hope that we pay more attention to it, and that is the rule of law. It seems to me that the most hopeful global institutions that we have to work for and create are the international courts, whether they be courts that create environmental legislation, whether they be courts that create just labor relations, as you were describing, or whether they be courts that arrest criminals. It is fascinating to me, and it's not to diminish what's happened on September the 11th, but in July 95, and none of the speakers have mentioned it, 8,000 people were killed on one day. The criminals' whereabouts are well known. They would be very easy to arrest without the means of air or seaborne forces, and they remain at large, and those 8,000 remain without justice. I only quote that as yet one more example in not of the hypocrisy, but of the failure of attention and the easy possibilities that do exist for rectifying it. Notably, the Muslim population in the Balkans, by the way, is absolutely behind the United States in its actions. I don't know how far those go, but I think it's an interesting point to throw in. So I want to put in a plug for both civil society and states working for that third force, which is actually the rule of law and institutions of justice, which could be a counterbalance to both. Because if we had a decent international criminal court to which the United States has signed up, we might perhaps not be bombing Afghanistan today, but using police action to arrest him. And that, to me, is what is really depressing. Thanks very much.
Thank you. And here.
Barry Buzan, I'm another professor of international studies.
How many are there?
Thousands. My question is where are the boundaries of global civil society? Because Jessica Woodruff mentioned that in her view this included people who were prepared to use violence in protests, and in that sense my question follows on from the previous one. I mean, if that's the case, then Osama bin Laden and the Mafia and Aung San Suu Kyi are all part of this as well. And yet, if you look at the book that we're introducing here, nonviolence is widely paraded in the definitions of what global civil society constitutes. So where are the boundaries, and how is this dark side dealt with?
Thank you. Right, fantastic amount of material there. I don't know whether we can possibly encompass it all in the next 10 minutes, which is, I guess, when we should end the meeting. The role of NGOs to make governments more accountable. Jessica, do you feel like compiling some of the thoughts that have come from the floor, perhaps? Yes, do.
A quick one on the role of the US, because for those of us who work with US protest movements, I just want to also make a plug for distinguishing between governments of any state and the citizens of that state. But I also think it's perhaps one of the myths of globalization that corporations are stateless. I don't know if you've heard the news about Huntington Life Sciences deciding to register in the States rather than the UK because its reporting requirements are less. And states, even under globalization, do still have a responsibility in relation to corporations. Coming on to the question up there about using the idea of corporate social responsibility and the fact that businesses are apparently interested in cleaning up their act. And at World Development Movement, we've viewed this with interest but some skepticism and have to a certain extent been involved in some of the discussions, but only to a certain extent, in that I do think partly what's happening is a recognition by business that it's a selling point to appear to be ethical. But I'm sure that it is also the case that there are people in business who are genuinely trying to be ethical. But I think that's always going to be to one side of the debate, in that there are certain things to do with national economic planning, which individual corporations, particularly multinationals, in that they're not based in that economy, are never going to do. And I think that's the point about maintaining a role for the state and the economy. Moving completely differently to this whole thing about what is global civil society. And I think in a sense, that's what I was trying to say comes back to both of your points down here in the front, is that if the concept of global civil society is to be useful, it perhaps has to be narrower, because otherwise it doesn't tell us very much about how to deal with people who feel the need to resort to violence. And clearly we need to deal with that, but an examination of how non-governmental organizations like my own or like Salil works tells us nothing about that. And so my concern is that we're piling in, as I think the questions demonstrate, this enormous diversity of questions into this one subject heading, which to me a bit makes my point that global civil society is perhaps too broad a concept to be useful.
So what about the purpose, say, of institutions of justice, that we had a point here? Do you think that that's one way of beginning to define who is in and who is out, as it were? John?
Yes. I think in terms of bringing democracy into international processes, intergovernmental processes, I think there's much that can be done. And indeed, in the years that I was working in the World Bank, I think we made a lot of progress in this direction. In terms of, and I think the elements of it have to be in terms of greater transparency of these institutions. In terms of accountability, is not just within the institutions, but there should be greater scrutiny. I mean, one good thing that you could say about the United States government is that it really monitors very carefully what the World Bank, what the IMF, probably what the other institutions do, in ways that, frankly, the British government, other European governments, and certainly developing country governments don't do. So I think greater accountability to national parliaments would be a good thing. I think there is much that can be done to develop consultation processes, again, something that I did a lot of within the World Bank, that enables, as Jessica said, the onus should be on officials in such institutions and indeed in national governments. The onus should be on them to do real listening, I think also international institutions need to have developed mechanisms of right of redress. If the World Bank finances an activity in which people are disadvantaged, there needs to be, and now we do have an inspection panel, which is imperfect, but is the beginnings of that right of redress. I wanted to touch on the point about the United States, and obviously when we've got very truncated time, we tend to use shorthands. And it's good to be reminded that we shouldn't talk simply about United States being hated and so on. The point, though, I think that Azana underlined, that we ought to reflect on, is why is there not uniform, but why is there a high degree amongst certain population groups of distrust that verges on hatred? And I think part of that is in the way in which the United States is, on the one hand, such a powerful economic force that it is the global leader, and yet paradoxically is one of the most parochial, inward-looking societies. And that I think, is something that really needs to change. The suggestion was made that the United States doesn't exert more than its due share of influence on international organizations. I mean, I've worked for 9 years in the World Bank, and I can tell you that's not true. It's very difficult for an institution like the World Bank to take a major policy that hasn't been minutely looked at and approved by the United States before it goes to the board. I may be talking out of turn in saying that, but that is how it works. And of course, the United Kingdom does take the lead in certain areas. The United Kingdom did start cancelling debts before the United States did, and perhaps led the US to follow that lead. Certainly the UK and all other countries continued paying their UN dues while the United States was reluctant to pay theirs, or refusing to pay theirs. So there are areas in which the sense of US arrogance and parochialism has to be understood.
Salim.
I mean, I think, I hope the point about the United States was made partly to be just provocative, because those of us who are engaged in, you know, any kind of negotiation or lobbying, we find that they're a serious block. And part of it, of course, is because they're bigger, they get bashed, etc. But and I'm sure the EU states use them as a kind of alibi at times. All that is true, but if linking it to the discussion of the point made about the International Criminal Court, or the support or the lack of it from the US to the UN system, to the Kyoto Protocol, I mean, any process at the global level which we're trying to introduce, which is rules-based and equal and fair, by and large, maybe they're the only ones who are bold enough to stand up and say we don't agree to these things being in any of the documents. In fact, most of the debates get held up with the US delegation saying, no, you can't say human rights, you can't say, you know, state responsibility, you can't do it. I mean, for every single, in the run-up to most UN conferences, and we had far too many of those in the last 10 years, I can't imagine any lobbyist campaigning group saying, if you ask who was blocking it, the answer is clear.
Sally, thank you. I want to ask Mary Caldor if she'd like to say a few words, because she's the director here at the LSE of the Centre for the Study of Global...
The Civil Society Programme.
Civil Society Programme. The Centre for the Study of Global Governments.
No, Meghnad's the director of the... Meghnad over there is the director. I just wanted to say a couple of things, because in a way we haven't had as much disagreement as I would have hoped. So I want to say, as the director of the Programme on Global Civil Society, one sceptical thing about civil society, and then I'd just like to answer Barry Bouzan's point. The sceptical thing is that we had a little meeting last week actually to discuss how we were going, some of the things we were going to do next year. And we discussed the meaning of civil society in different cultural contexts. And what we found was a huge resentment of the concept of civil society in certain parts of the world. There is a sense that civil society has been taken up by the World Bank, it's been taken up by other institutions. NGOs have been funded. The argument is that if you're going to have market reform, you also need a civil society. So we will fund NGOs to teach you how to have a civil society. And we will train people in fundraising and in proposal writing and in lobbying and in providing a social safety net, because the government can't provide it. And we will use these NGOs to smooth the way of market reform. And what we observed, particularly among people from Africa and India, was a sense that a whole army of Western-type NGOs had invaded their countries and actually blocked indigenous protests and indigenous movements. So I say this in case we sound like enthusiasts, to say this is one of the big objections to the term, and also, and that was Robert Wade's point, to substitute for domestic democratic processes. The other point I wanted to make was a response to the point, what are the boundaries of civil society? And actually, we don't actually say necessarily civil society is nonviolent. What we say is that actually the concept is fuzzy and contested. And in fact, we've had enormous debates in the process, which have been very interesting and stimulating, about precisely the question where the boundaries are, and have come to the conclusion, actually, that we can't make hard and firm boundaries, and that you can't simply include the nice guys and exclude the nasty guys. And Lynn Jones here was absolutely right in saying we have to include the nationalist and fundamentalist networks as part of civil society, and the issue is, how do we create a conversation which involves these people? That's what having a global civil society is about. So it's both an aspiration and, in a sense, because such a conversation is beginning to happen in different ways, though whether it will continue to happen after September the 11th, I'm not sure. I think it very much depends on what happens in the next few weeks. That conversation is really what we are both trying to be part of and trying to report on in our yearbook.
No, thank you very much indeed. Well, I think we should end there. Clearly, an hour and a half and three speakers on the stage isn't enough to even begin to tackle all the questions, very, very complex issues that are raised both by this book and by this meeting tonight. We should have what we used to have in the 60s, which were teach-ins that go on for days and days and days. We used to have them here at the LSE, I hear. That you may feel that we're whistling in the wind, you may feel completely dissatisfied with the state of the discussion tonight, and in that case I take full responsibility for not having pulled the right questions out of the audience. But I think the terribly important thing about it all is that we have these sort of conversations and that we involve people in their own democracies, and that we have, one of the things that I admire about America is that it is, whatever its mistakes, a vibrant, alive democracy. And if we have vibrant, alive democracies and not secrecy like we appear to have more and more of in this country, then perhaps we can begin at least to know what the questions are, because I think it was Rilke who said, live the answers, don't keep looking for the questions. I mean, live the questions, don't keep looking for the answers. which makes a bit more sense. So let's end there. There are some drinks and some music, I think, upstairs in the senior common room, and an announcement from... I think he wants the panel to leave first.
He wants us to leave first.
It's very polite. Thank you all very much indeed for your questions. Thank you for turning up.
I don't want to leave first at all. I would have thought you were leaving first.
And thank you very much to the panel for coming this evening. Thank you.